The Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. PCGS is celebrating its 30th anniversary with a collectible medal. Go to PCGS.com to learn more. The always peppery Harvey Stack is an icon of American numismatics, whose career spans an entire lifetime and connects today's collector with the household names of yesteryear. In this Coin Week podcast, we travel back in time to talk about great collectors and great collections, and the great issues that face the rare coin business. Hi there, I'm with my good friend, legendary numismatist and lifer in the hobby, co-founder of Stacks Bowers, the man himself, Harvey Stack. How are you doing today, Harvey?
I'm doing quite fine.
So, Harvey, last week we saw the fourth session of the Stacks Bowers sale, the D. Brent Pogue Family Collection, a landmark sale in the history of the hobby. How does the Pogue sale rate compared to all the famous collections that you've been a part of in your lifetime?
Well, unquestionably, it's the largest single ownership sale that we have ever been involved with. It already exceeded the record which we held from selling the John J. Ford collection through a 24 sale. I guess you'd have to call it a marathon, which brought over close to $60 million. The Pogue sale has exceeded that amount already.
So if you had to give a top five of the great important collections that you've handled, what would they be?
Let me go down the list almost chronologically, if I could. The largest, most important collections in my early days was the Louis E. Eliasberg collection, which my family sold the nucleus of the George H. Clapp collection in 1942 to Louis Eliasberg, who was trying to build a complete collection of United States coins, gold, silver, and copper. And he did accomplish that. After that, we did sell the H.R. Lee collection, which is the Louis E. Eliasberg collection, Lee being the using his initials, L-E-E, because he didn't want many people to know he was selling. But they were the duplicates he had from what he had originally started and what came from duplicates that he got from the Clapp collection. From that point on, in 1954, we sold both the Davis Graves collection and the Anderson DuPont collection. And those were very important collections in their own days. And then since then, we had a list of other major sales, each being specialists in their own area, like the Gibson collection of Colonial America, the R.L. Miles collection of almost complete United States coins, the Ashna collection of United States silver and copper coins, the Baffert collection, which is talked about to this very day. And from there on, we've had, of course, in 2002, the 1933 Double Eagle, which was a single coin lot, which established at that time a world record of $7.6 million. The company has sold the 1794 Cardinal Silver Dollar for $10 million. And, of course, the one that held the record before, which was the John J. Ford collection, was another one of our milestone collections. So therefore, from almost the time I entered the business, well, I entered it as a child also, as you can imagine. I used to call myself an indentured slave because the first 5 or 6 years or 7 years I was in the business, I worked with any time I didn't have to go to school in the shop and learned more about numismatics than anybody could have ever been exposed to, because we were fortunate enough to have a vast number of good collectors located in the metropolitan New York area. And they used to visit Stacks because Stacks was considered the clubhouse in New York for collectors during that period. To this day, it still is, but not as much as it was back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Why was New York City such a great coin city?
Well, New York City was a great coin city for several reasons. It bordered Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., which, of course, where our mint was started. It bordered, in a way, Washington, D.C. and Baltimore within easy traveling distance to New York. It also was next to New Jersey. Many, many coin collectors came from there. For example, Bearford and Joseph Spray all came from there. The Westchester area, which is north of the city, and then, of course, Connecticut had a tremendous amount of coin collectors in it. It was the proximity to each other, the clubs that were formed. There were 11 clubs in the 1960s just in the metropolitan area. Almost every borough had one. Every state had one. And we even had people who used to travel down quite often from the Boston area because it was within, I hate to use the word shooting distance, but it was within the way of a day travel back and forth. So that's how New York became it. And because of the mint's notoriety in Philadelphia, that became an initial hub which spread to New York because that seems to be where the collectors seem to want to congregate.
So the Stack family has had a family coin business since the 1930s, and you've spent essentially your entire life around the business. As a youngster, who was the first major collector that you ever came into contact with?
Colonel E.H. Green.
So what was the Colonel like?
He was a very unusual person. He would be what I would call a bulk buyer. He would come in almost every Saturday, which were the days that I came into the office more regularly because I didn't have to go to school. And he would come in and say, well, what do you got that's different for me today? So my father and uncle might have had some coins set aside in a tray expecting him to visit or had sorted some things out. And if he asked him, let's say, do you have any Spanish colonial coins today? Oh, he would say yes. And we'd take out a tray full of doubloons, which were only $35 or $40 a piece at the time, and show it to him. He would look at that or he would look at some United States gold coins the same way. And let's say he had five or six trays, and each tray had 30 or 40 coins in it, in little boxes on display. He would say, well, how much for this whole group? And the folks would quote him a price. He'd sit for a second and think and say, I'll take it. He had his chauffeur who was parked out in front come into the shop, pick up the five trays, put them in the trunk of the car, and he would disappear that day. Monday morning, as the clock struck 10, in came the chauffeur with the empty trays, almost like saying, okay, fill them up and get it for the colonel.
Wow. So it seems like back then that collectors would have to stop by the shop often so as not to get scooped on good coins.
Well, they came in, people in general came in, because what happened was New York, the shop became known as a clubhouse. And why was it a clubhouse? New York had a 5.5-day work week all for many, many, many years, especially through the 30s through the late 60s, maybe early 70s. And what happened was when the collector came in, let's say from surrounding areas or lived in Manhattan itself, when they got the time off, they'd come over to the shop, meet their fellow collectors there in the shop, sit down and talk numismatics for hours, and then we would buy something from them occasionally. More times we would sell to them. But they always were discussing coins, and they let people like myself and my two cousins, Joseph's sons, Norman and Ben, sit around and listen to them chat and discuss and even argue varieties and books. And even the newcomer came in, and he used to come in and sit and talk to my father, but he was writing his book on the large sense from 1860 to 1857, and which was the most unusual book I've ever saw originally, because it was all hand printed in the hand, and each of the cents were hand drawn, and we were fortunate enough to have the opportunity of publishing it for him. But this is the kind of person that came to me and educated me and who influenced me all the years I was involved in the numismatics.
When did you take over the family business?
I took over the business, my share of the business, in 1967, when my father passed away. I was a partner already in 1955, but full-time 1967. My two cousins, Norman and Ben, had their shares, and Joseph was still alive, and he had his share. Joseph died about 1982 from a heart attack, and he was the senior member of the firm at the time. And then the next year, because of some bad disease, Ben died in 1983. Norman died in 1992. All along those times, I had a senior position because I represented the company on many, many endeavors that we had. Everything from fighting the government in 1961 through 1967 on the import restrictions on gold coins into the United States, which I'm happy to say we won, being part of the grading seminar in 1973 of Hobby Protection Act. Then, of course, in 1976, I served on the U.S. Assay Commission, and holding my senior position in the firm, I did many, many of these things for the industry as well as for the company.
So when you took over in the beginning, how was the numismatic industry different than it was during your father's time?
Well, it wasn't different because it was similar, except it started to change. But let's go back to a period. There was a change in interest. People got stimulated to collect when the proof sets came back in 1950. They came back again when they started to collect coins in Whitman albums to a greater extent, and people wanted things to fill in. So rolls and late date issue of the period was collected by many, and dealers maintained the stock. There was a slowdown in selling in the 1950s of major collections, except the few that we were lucky to get. And then it went on, and it kept changing because all of a sudden you had the silver restrictions that came in 1961 originally. The gold restriction in 1961 and the silver restrictions in 1970 when the silver started to go up in the years before, and all of a sudden the government said you can't melt the silver coins anymore. So these things kept going on and on and had influence on the business, and different elements of people joined it. So not everybody stayed as professional numismatists. Some went into wholesale businesses. Others went into bullion businesses. And as each thing influenced the coin business, you picked up a little yourself, even though you tried to be dedicated to coins. So that's the period. The 60s was a crazy period of changes going on. And the markets were not jumping as rapidly as they say today. There was sensation of coin collections of note coming on the market. And we were fortunate, like, for example, to buy in the 1950s the Anderson DuPont and the Davis Graves collection rather than spend our money at the Farouk sale, which was the same year. So we had to make our own decisions. I'm sure other dealers did the same thing. Some went as far as Egypt in the 1950s to get some coins, and others traveled to various conventions. Conventions were different. There are only three or four major shows a year, not like 20 a week sometimes in that you see advertised. And we would go to some of them, and we would go and meet the collectors where we felt the more advanced collector would show up, and in the cities and areas where they would come. So there was lots of changes. And, of course, we kept excelling ourselves in the auction business, and that has been a very mainstay even to this very day. Saks itself has been responsible for at least 800 auction sales through the period. And this is all separate catalog, separate sales. And that's not counting like 24 sales for Ford. So it gives you an idea that the breadth of the changes that we had. There's also less publications, much less publications. The guidebook was like the main tool. Because what happened in 1947, Waite Raymond stopped publishing the periodical standard catalog. And then, of course, you had publications like Numismatic News and Coin World that came in the 50s. And the numismatist was really a bit of a advertising medium for the collector, but didn't get into offering too many things. They were more writing about some new thing that was happening or some club that had something to do or some history of some of the coins. It is advanced now to more being written. Of course, publications like Coin Week are making a tremendous inroad because I believe that more people take time to read it. And the stories keep changing, and I have to love the publication for that reason. They take all sides of all subjects and make it important. That is what the people need. We don't weekly publications, monthly publications, yearly publications have their place, but they're more summaries usually than advanced. Publications like you edit, like Coin Week, does speak to many people every week. And even companies like ourselves try to mimic you a little bit because Stacks has its own newsletter that is published under blogs in our website every week, which just gives us a lot of things about what we do, but other things about some numismatics that's going on. But yours is much broader. Congratulations for that.
You mentioned the collection of Colonel Green. Recently, one of your illustrious competitors has had the opportunity of offering the coins from the collection of Eric P. Newman. And Newman benefited tremendously from having the opportunity to buy a large portion of the coins that once were housed in the collection of Colonel Green. Now, with many of these coins, all of which have been certified now, of course they weren't then, come an original envelope that Colonel Green kept the coins in. And on these envelopes are the prices that were paid for the coins. Some of these are now four, five, six-figure coins, and for nearly all of these coins, he paid pennies on the dollar based on what they're worth now in today's market. But my question to you is this. Was it such a situation back then, before there was really a strong American middle class, that even at these types of prices that most people could not have afforded to buy these kinds of coins?
Some were, but don't forget they had some advantages which we don't have today. One is they could find many, many of the beginning of collections in change. They found everything from cents to dollars available in their change. The Whitman publication albums and the cards before them all provided a incentive to try to complete. And of course, they tried to complete as good as somebody else that they saw, equal to somebody else or better than what they could do. And if you found a better one, you exchange it for the poorer one. So you had a different element that started that way. So therefore it became the specialist. And yes, I would say some of them were extremely well-heeled, and yet many we sold to, we used to work for us for 3, 4, 5 weeks, and their pay was a coin that they had set aside. So it worked both ways. And there was more old-time collections being broken up, so therefore certain what we consider rare today were less scarce at that time because a lot of the old-timers saved things not only in their albums and in the duplicates, but also saved them in rolls and had them set aside. This could have been a bag full of circulated Indian pennies or a small bag of shield nickels that were all that they got from the mint or through their families through the years. The silver coins were plentiful. I mean, dimes, quarters, halves for surely were around. A cent of nickels was an everyday piece. I know many a person who traveled across the country back in that period could get virtually a complete set of Lincoln cents by looking at their change every day. because when they got into the Denver area, they found Denver coins. When they got into the San Francisco area, they found San Francisco coins. And around the New York area, which is so close to Philadelphia, they found the Philadelphia coins. So, and then dealers also would do what we did if they were had any respect for those who came in to buy. If they missed a coin in the last year or two and the dealer had already accumulated some rolls of them because he either bought them direct from the mint or handled them, he gave them to the collector or sold them to him at such a modest price that you didn't have the middle, you could have been a pauper virtually and own a cent, nickel, dime, or a quarter of the period because the minimal premiums we used to charge were very, very low. So therefore, it's a different world. What's happened is that each time a collection gets broken up, and this is what the people don't realize, nobody will ever put together, for example, a Pogue collection again because Pogue had a little over 600 coins, and theoretically they could have ended up in 600 different collections. They probably will not. There will be probably some in 3 collections, 5 collections, 10 collections. Even going back to the days when Eliasburg was being sold, and I represented Bass at the Eliasburg collection for a number of his coins, he had a list of about 30 coins he wanted to get. He got about 26 of them at the sale. He lost, for example, the 1822 to the Pogues, but which was actually Dave Akers was the agent for the Pogues at that time. And what happened is that that collection we cannot be reassembled like Eliasburg had because it was several unique coins in the collection, and therefore they either ended up in a collection that may be sold again maybe 50 years from now or could have been sold 5 years ago. So it's not the same coins that are not assembled. So it's the availability that most of these collectors don't realize, that when you break up a collection, and I have to use Pogue, or even take somebody like Ford, who had thousands and thousands of different colonial coins and paper money and things like this, when it gets broken up, it's not going to get put together again. FCC Boyd was a great provider of coins and currency to Ford, and Ford kept part of the things he bought from him and sold others off, which were duplicates. But you don't have another FCC boy putting away piles of things, no more than you have a Brandt collection, also was a hoarder of a lot of coins. I mean, a lot of these people had them because they buy it. They always wrote about Louis Eliasburg. He always said he sometimes would buy an entire collection to get some of the missing links that he needed for his collection. And then he would put them aside, and then that all became part of the H.R. Lee collection being sold. He didn't need the money, but he just didn't need the bulk around him. So we sold it. So, I mean, this is what happened in my early days, and it repeats itself in different forms in the modern days. And I'm proud to be been part of the building of many of the most renowned collections of the United States, going back from in my day, for starting with the Eliasburg collection and the what do you call it, and now going on to the Pogue. I don't think I'll ever see something that'll exceed the Pogue in value. It surely will not exceed it in quality and rarity. And yet, if you notice, Pogue primarily is 1837 and earlier, because he himself could not see trying to go where Eliasburg did and only the finest stone, because that's what he wanted. So it became a different venture, if you want to call it, or job and chore to do. So he stayed within a particular area.
What do you figure an Eliasburg collection and top pop finest known coins would cost today, assuming that someone had the physical means of even getting the coins?
Well past the 150 to 200 million that they think the Pogue is involved.
What role did investment spur collectors to get involved with the coin hobby, let's say from the 1930s to the 1960s?
Yeah, as let's use United States because I don't want to talk about the rest of the world, even though I know something about it. In the United States, you had, after 1933, an interest in collecting gold coins. People did not want to surrender their gold coins. And the in the laws of 33 and 34, there was a provision that collectors could be exempt from turning theirs in. And even they said, but you can't have more than two each of every date mint of the $2.50 gold piece. The reason being, I believe that the Chinese workers that were here from the custom that they had of owning gold were buying up only $2.50 gold because that was a lot of money in the 1930s. So they put a limit on that. Gold dollars were out of circulation, so you wouldn't have had them. So they really were collector's items. $3 gold were out of circulation, you wouldn't have them. But everything else could, 2.5, 5s, 10s, and 20s could be gotten. That was a spur on. And after that, the changes of designs in the 1930s came into being in the early 40s. So these were the things that stimulated people to collect, together with the fact that the country got wealth back after all the severe losses that they had in depressions. And if you could look back from years ago, in old cookie jars that might have been grandma had, or an old drawer in a piece of furniture that's up in the attic they opened up, they always put away a couple of coins. And that got people interested in having more, or learning more about it. And, of course, literature started to get more prolific. Coin clubs started to grow. The ANA became more, dedicated to all collectors, not just those who had a lot of money. And then, of course, to tell you how far back, you know, the A-Day was started back in the 1840s. Do you know the first official auction that they had in connection with an American Numismatic Association convention was in 1939 in New York? Stacks had the pleasure of being the first auctioneer.
Let's get back to another coin that Louis Elias Burke once had in his collection, but didn't have at the time his collection was sold, the 1933 Double Eagle. Your firm is the only firm existing today that has had the opportunity to sell that coin not once, but several times.
Yes.
What was the thinking about that coin when it was offered, before the government got involved, and I believe stopped the sale of it in 1947?
They stopped the sale because what happened was the coin was written up in a new, at that time we had a big coin page in the New York Times on Sunday. And I don't remember the name of the, right this second, who wrote the column. But he writes about, gee, Sachs is selling something that has not been around and may not be legal. So all of a sudden they came into and they picked up the coin from the Wharton collection. And Wharton asked us to fight it for him, and we did. But it didn't win it, but we didn't have the same type of research background that went into winning the case now, if you know, the only way I can tell you. So we worked with the David Tripp, who was on one, he was on the negative side of the deal of the 1933, and we worked with the attorneys that represented the owners of the 1933 that became finally a joint venture between the United States Mint and the owners.
So what was the government's argument for seizing the coin?
It was struck according to what they found at the, in the 40s. It was struck not under the official registrar's office at the U.S. Mint. That's the only thing they said. But they, meanwhile, the 1933 $10 was struck before the act of the Gold Act. So the argument was they were trying to take the old records and confiscate something. They actually kept the Secret Service busy at the time.
Well, I don't know if this is the kind of question you want to answer, but were there other 33s that you heard about or had a suspicion that might be floating around but didn't come out into the open?
I believe so. I've heard of a couple of them, but I would never repeat it because I'm not sure it's true. Everybody can say something. Hey, you know, I own a 1933 also. I said, can I see it? No.
Well, I have a bag of 1804 dollars that I pulled up from the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea.
If I could prove that they were made at the time, I'd be happy to sell them for you.
So thinking back to the government's argument about the 33, that seems like a very specific argument. But recently, the government seized a 1974D aluminum cent experimental pattern from a dealer out of La Jolla, California. It seems to me that if the government is going to start seizing coins that weren't officially issued by the Mint, then that opens a dangerous precedent for the hobby. I mean, the 1913 nickels, for one, weren't exactly legally made.
I'm not arguing with you about that, and nobody knows what law or so. The thing was using the 33 as a focal point. The thing is that you must consider, and I think it's a very important thing to consider, that they had a law that they were trying to enforce. They were going around the same Secret Service agents that picked up the others in the 1940s primarily, under the guidance of their great leader and the great coin collector who didn't know much about coins, Leland Howard, who directed part of the pickups, and who came later on, I fought in 1961 for the gold import license because they made him chairman of the committee, of the office, I should say. The problem is that they had a edict that 1933 was a taboo date for the 20. Whether they thought that somebody stole it from the Mint, whether they exchanged it, my opinion is they really never lost anything but a digit. Because the people, what you used to be able to do is take, for example, your 22 silver dollars, and walk into the bank and say, look, I have a birthday for somebody in 1923. Can I give you 5 1922s and you give me 5 1923s? And they did the same thing with gold coins. They would, in other words, people would give some as gifts or have them for a date. They would just exchange coin for coin. And my opinion is the registrar might have had 10,000 coins in his till, theoretically. But he had... and they never found a coin missing. They always had the exact count. And if you think they kept track of what was in each till, it wasn't until it got all this publicity that it came out.
So last week, Stax Bowers offered the fourth selection of the coins from the D. Brent Poe collection. Please tell Coin Week readers, many of whom may not have the means to buy coins at these price levels, but may or may one day be Stax Bowers customers, why they should care about the auction of the D. Brent Poe collection.
I think it's psychologically one of the driving forces by anybody is how much is it going to be worth if I sell it or leave it to my heirs in the future? Am I doing something that could be beneficial only to my ego, or is it something that will also be a good foundation that I leave for my family? And therefore, if they see it going up, one, like the stock market, when a number one stock, a group of stocks start going up, but a lot of them seem to be pulled along with it. If they start going down, a lot of them get pulled down with it. In other words, the penny stocks suffer dramatically when the stock market goes down. And the blue chips seem to get better on the way, but as they get better on the way up, because they earn more, they invest better, they have better product, all of a sudden they become an influence on the rest of the market. Not everybody is a Pfizer or a Lilly or any of the other drug companies. Yet when they come out with something new and it's going to make more money, that drags all the drug companies up, other better blue chips. It also leaves behind all the small ones that are around, you know, that make one pill or do some generic manufacture. It's a matter of market vitality, I guess you'd have to call it.
So in other words, if coins at the top are doing great, getting international media attention, then if you're a collector putting together a 20th century type set, for instance, you are helped because people have a good impression of coins and the coin market.
That is correct.
Well, thanks, Harvey, for stopping by. It's always a pleasure, and I always learn so much from talking to you. Take care, my friend. Thank you.